Yes. Here comes a mic.
I get the yawning effect. I use EFT or tapping, acupuncture tapping, and you will get yawning. I think the key is that if you don't focus in, if you're mindless and you're off someplace and you do the exercise, does it still work? Because I think you need the focus to be connected. That's my thought.
I think the psychological part helps. It helps to be the physical. And notice, by the way, that this looks kind of like alpha waves, only it's about, 100 times as slow. It's a harmonic of alpha waves. So if you continue doing this kind of breathing, it puts you in a kind of an alpha relaxed awareness state. Somebody in the, over here? Okay, yes.
Going back a little bit.
Point the thing at you, I'm told, is the best.
Can you hear me?
Good.
Going back a little bit, you talked about alpha and beta and rapid eye movement part of sleep. Some people self-medicate with marijuana, and that messes up their REM sleep, correct?
Probably so. It can.
If
especially the strong marijuana that's around these days.
Would neurofeedback be a therapy to help people who are self-proclaimed marijuana addicts?
I do try to get my teenage clients who get stoned a lot to not do it and to find other ways of doing it. And sometimes I say to them, as they're hooked up to the neurofeedback device, I'm going to get you stoned without drugs. And we try to do that because the evidence is now in, the neurophysiological evidence is in, that the brains of people under 21 years of age are not really settled and fully formed, and there is something called the arcuate fasciculus. It's a white matter tract that goes from the back of the brain to the front of the brain that doesn't get developed. And so that's where the language is located. That's the part that was missing in poor Michael. And that's why when you talk to teenagers, they say, yeah, man, awesome, groovy. Anything else? Yeah, man, that's awesome. Anything else? Yeah, groovy. Yes. Okay, well, it's for the tape.
When I was taught breathing like this, I was taught to have a longer exhale than inhale, so 5-second inhale, 7-second exhale. I find that that works better for me. Do you have any comments about that?
I think it's legitimate. There are yoga breaths that are longer on the exhale than on the inhale. What the biofeedback community says, if you want to look this up, look up the work of Stephen Elliott, E-L-I-O-T. He's the contemporary authority on the length. They go for an even in-breath and out-breath 5 to 8 times per minute based on your own age, size, comfort level, that kind of thing. It's a ballpark thing. I think the important thing is to feel comfortable.
Okay. The last thing is, Dr. Dan Siegel just published a new book called Brainstorm on adolescent brain development. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, he's saying 25, not 21.
Good, thank you. He's saying 25?
Yeah.
So I really work with a lot of adolescents who are getting stoned all the time are brought to me, and I'm going, oh, I know how much fun it is, guys. I know how it makes the world seem all magical and all that kind of stuff, and try not to do it until you're older than 25 at least. Yes.
There was a very recent news article that reported a study in which deep rhythmic breathing controlled blood pressure better than medication. Are you aware of that study?
If you'd give me the reference, I'd be happy to read it.
I don't remember the name, but it was within the last month.
Yeah. I'd be delighted to get an email from you, and I'll give you that information in just a minute, by the way. So this is just to show you, by the way, that biofeedback is I think we have time. Go ahead.
Are you familiar with
cranioelectrical stimulation.
Yes, CES.
Is that a form of neurofeedback?
You know, it's not feedback. It's stimulation.
Right.
It's an artificial energy that is coming in. I won't say it doesn't work. There are many kinds that do work. The Fisher-Wallace device, the alpha stim, they kind of work on the brain stem. They can help for sleep. Some are known to help with alcohol and marijuana addictions. They're pretty helpful. So CES is a different thing than biofeedback. The lens biofeedback, and I'm happy to give more of a description of that to people or even take a peek in The Healing Power of Neurofeedback. There's an exact description. It takes about, the book is 400 pages, so it's hard to give in five words or less how the thing actually works. But I do get around it in 400 pages. Yes?
Yeah, it might be an obvious question, but so why is yawning contagious?
Why is yawning contagious? Very good question. I don't know. But I've got a clever answer.
Okay.
It may or may not be right. Rizzolatti and companions at the University of Parma in Italy discovered about 12, 15 years ago something called mirror neurons in the brain. These are a different type of neuron than the pyramidal neurons that engage in most of our, you know, motor activity and stuff like that. These are different. These are called the monkey see, monkey do neurons. And those neurons have us imitating things around us. I'm going to talk more about that in the fundamentalist mind, how I talk about how looking at the monkey on the top of the hierarchy, I've got to imitate that monkey. You know, sure it is. Your mother and child couldn't do their thing without those mirror neurons. Yes.
I just had a quick comment on the comment the lady made about synchronizing with the two-year-old and feeling like stealing. I would think of that in terms of synchronization,
mm-hmm.
where both the child and the adult are strengthened by sharing with each other. It doesn't appear to me to be stealing.
Yeah, that comment needs to be on there. Thank you.
When I say sense of stealing, I'm talking about this is something so disavowed and unacknowledged in the culture, and yet it's such a source of strength, power, human connection, da-da-da. I mean, that's what my head says, but in my heart, I have no idea. I just know I feel like this is counter to what I'm supposed to be doing with my life to be successful.
If any of you ever gets a chance to study with my friend and colleague, Dr. Richard Brown, he teaches all over the East Coast and actually all over the world coherent breathing with Qigong exercises, and he teaches it to 9/11 survivors and people who are really traumatized, and it makes a huge, huge difference. This works with trauma.
Hi. To go back to the yawning and the mirror neurons for a minute... The thing is, if we just go to the neurology of it, there's a morphic field, let's say, created among us all, so that we're all, for example, right now, more interested and animated following this, and even more yawning because of the breathing. So what I'm trying to get to is what is the... Do we have to separate these levels of feeling and the mental movement of the neurons in the brain? I'm thinking of Daniel Siegel,
mm-hmm.
who says we are, the whole of us is an embodied brain. So the brain, maybe you can interpret what I'm trying to get at here. But it's the connection between feeling and thought, basically, I guess.
A friend of mine, Rupert Sheldrake, is the guy who formulated the morphogenetic field idea, and it really is something real. A group like this that has been meeting In a similar way, with periods of silence and worship and instruction and mutual support and balance, creates a morphic field that I believe endures over the years and decades. And you can probably feel it when you come to the group. I certainly began to feel it immediately when I came to be vetted at Pendle Hill. It was a really palpable, noticeable feeling. I said, this is a cool group. I bet this conference is going to be really great. And when you're lecturing, by the way, Joseph Campbell used to say this, when you're lecturing to a bunch of kindred souls, the energy just rises up and you're all really kind of together having the same experience. Somebody back here, yes.
I just wanted to give you an anecdote about yawning that was convincing to me. When I was teaching young children many years ago who had cerebral palsy, and when I found myself yawning and this child who could hardly open his mouth yawned. So that's when I looked and said, "There, you know, this is not just anecdotal, and this is just not what we say. This really happens, and with someone who can't really consciously control." So I think the mirror neuron theory is probably very accurate after that experience. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I'm interested in hearing the Jung Campbell anecdote.
Thank you for asking. It's one of my favorite stories, and I heard it from Joe's own lips actually many times. Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung only met one time. I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, the year was 1953. It was after the Aranos conferences, the Bullingen conferences they were called sometimes, in Aranos, Ascona, on Lago Maggiore in the Italian part of the Alps. And I think Jung was kind of getting tired of he was already in his late 70s, early 80s, getting tired of being at the forum and the conference. He was staying home more. He had taken a fall, hurt himself. By the way, Carl Jung had a terrible head injury, and he was also sexually traumatized by a priest. And thereafter, he had an unearthly dread of men in black cassocks. And he did not like Catholicism. It made him more a Protestant. By the way, I really recommend Deirdre Baer's biography of Jung. You don't know the man if you haven't read that biography. It's almost 1,000 pages, and it's detailed. It took me almost a year to read it. And some parts of it were kind of depressing, so I put it down, and then I'd go back to it again. But on this occasion, Jung had read Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces, and he wanted to meet this brash young man who dared to talk about mythology when he was the great mythologist and so forth. So Joe and Jean drove from Ascona, and Robin and I have done this drive. You have to drive in the tunnels underneath Mont Blanc. You have to enter the underworld, right? So it's a mythic journey you're on. And then, to make it even more mythic, Joe and Jean crossed a railroad track. At some point I'll show my slides of Jung's Tower at Bollingen, because I visited a number of times. But to get there, you have to cross a railroad track, and they got lost in Bollingen. They couldn't find the place, and just as they crossed the track, one of those absolutely silent, deadly Swiss trains just about cut their car in half. And they both sat there shivering for a little while. That's what you do, as Peter Levine says, when you've had a trauma. And Joe said, "I think we just passed through the Symplegades, the clashing rocks in the Argonaut Odyssey." And they came to the door and knocked on the door, and there was Mrs. Jung, all kindly and sweet. And by the way, as you're going to see, you can orient your attention to this. Emma Jung was a long-suffering, very wonderful lady. She also happened to be the second wealthiest woman in Switzerland. And that is how Carl Jung was able to do all his shenanigans. he didn't have to earn a living. He could earn a living. He did earn a living, but he could just, you know, live very, very comfortably. And you'll see that in A Dangerous Method. You'll see the moment when Jung and Freud are about to get on the steamship and go to America to Clark University. It's quite a telling moment, 1909. 1909. Anyway, Mrs. Jung invited them in, and there was Carl Jung out on the little piazza by the lake, overlooking the Zurich Lake, the Zurichsee. And he looked to go out there and feed the swans, which I also did, following in his footsteps. And Jung would cook these outrageous dishes that he made up totally by himself. He was a master cook, but it was always unpremeditated and kind of wild, and he was doing one of those meals. And he greeted them very cordially, and they had a glass of wine, and he said, "So, Professor Campbell, what can you tell me about the word Aum?" And Campbell drew himself up to his full 6 feet in height, and he was about to launch into a scholarly disquisition on Aum, because it was one of his favorite subjects, and the Mandukya Upanishad was one of his favorite books. And he was about to start, and Carl Jung said, no. Let me tell you about Aum. He said, when I was in a psychoanalytic conference with Freud and Ferenczi and Binswanger and all of those guys, one of the professors gave a most brilliant paper. It covered all the bases. And the entire audience went, He said, and then again, he said, I was with a group of travelers and we were taken up to the Taiga tops in India, and you could see the sun rise over the Himalayas, and when the sun rose over the Himalayas, it touched those crystal peaks with a million rainbow colors, and everybody in the group went, And then, when I was in deepest Africa, we were suddenly surrounded by the Maasai warriors with their lion spears. And it took us a while to meet everybody's eyes and see that we all were good people. And we squatted down in a circle and looked at each other and said,